This is the Conference Committee on Senate Bill 323, De-Engrossed. We are meeting June 17, 1987 at 1:30 p.m. in Hearing Room 350.
The Conference Committee has been appointed in reference to Senate Bill 323, and we have Senator Brenneman present, Representative Dix is present, Representative Springer, Senator Cohen, and Representative Phillips will be in shortly. I think the first thing I'd like, well, let me say the first is we will have a kind of a first round feeling out process among the conferees today. I think the Senate members at least would like to hear some of the thinking that went into the deletion of parts of the Senate bill that we think are important, and the addition of other matters that we have some question about. So we're interested in getting the views of the House members. I want everybody to have a chance to just give all of us an overview as to where you're coming from on this. And then we're going to try and work out a schedule for the next meeting. This meeting today is not going to go beyond 3 o'clock, that's for sure. It might end sooner, but we won't be making any decisions today. We're just going to kind of get acquainted with our differences, and we can each assess before we how long we think it's going to take to resolve those, when we're going to meet again, and so forth. So first, counsel for the conference committee is Catherine Weber and of the House committee, and my own staff counsel, Gary Caldwell, is so the two of them will be helping us try to get through this. Carlson, I mean. Caldwell's in South Dakota, or is that Wyoming? So, with that, counsel, can you explain what these materials are that we've got in the book?
Yes, we are starting a notebook for you, which contains, either on a single page or on opposite pages, the sections of the C-engrossed version, which is the Senate version, and the D-engrossed version, the House version, which differ. If the sections are alike, at this point, they're not going to show up in the green notebook. And I will, by the end of the day, have an index that shows which sections are alike and which sections differ. And by the next time you meet, I hope that this will be complete with every section that differs between the two versions. If you're only interested in substantive differences, then I'll probably leave out the stuff where there's simply a technical change in wording. Otherwise, it'll all show up. If you have anything more that you want in the way of analysis, we'd be glad to try and provide it. The book is laid out so that it's hopefully easy to compare the sections. That's the object behind the way it's done. I have been through both the C and D versions and have a pretty good idea of where the differences are. I'll have to rely on Catherine to help me figure out why those exist, if you want explanations from counsel.
All right. Has everybody been supplied with the staff measure analysis? The Senate members been supplied with the House staff measure analysis, which might help us. If you don't have that, why, we'll get it to you. I'm wondering also if Catherine Weber's comparison chart would be helpful to all the members to have. I've got one. Representative Springer's probably got one. Does anybody else have?
What's that?
It's a kind of a comparison chart.
I have some, but I don't.
It looks like this.
Don't have that.
Okay. I think that might be helpful to have, too, by way of kind of summary. overview of the differences here. It's four pages. I think I'd like to start by asking Representative Springer and also all three members from the House on this, but maybe starting with Representative Springer. We'll just start a discussion, and we can either go through the Green Book page by page, or we can just take the issues as they've been summarized. And
Mr. Chair,
yes, go ahead.
I've asked our staff to put in a call to Representative Phillips' office to try to determine if he can join us as quickly as possible. I believe that it was Representative Dix and Representative Phillips who were the carriers on the floor, and the folks who are probably most familiar with the version that passed the House. And I think Representative Dix indicated to me just a little bit earlier that it was his understanding that Representative Phillips was probably the person who might lead off in terms of an explanation of some of the issues that are presented by the differences in the House bill. So I might ask your patience for just a couple more moments here while we track down Representative Phillips. I think he would probably be in a better position than I am at this point to speak to some of those, and then Representative Dix may have some additional comments as well.
Okay, I was kind of lollygagging around here, hoping that Paul would show up before we got started.
I could probably start.
Go ahead. Sure.
Why don't we start with the caps question, which is at least the third or fourth one in, and then probably is the area of.
Should that be page seven?
Six and seven. The way in which we arrived at the difference, the $50,000 difference in the cap, was like some of the other issues in the bill, through a long discussion over the fairness over instituting an arbitrary flat cap on non-economic damages. The initial draft that came out of the subcommittee was a $400,000 cap with exemptions for quadriplegia, paraplegia, wrongful death, I believe, burn victims. Originally it was 70% third degree burn victims. We were going to amend that in full committee to 50%, having found out once we got the bill out of subcommittee that almost all victims at 70% die. That would have been amended in full committee had we stuck with that approach to the cap. Several members of the committee that Representative Phillips and I were negotiating with at the time felt there were some constitutional problems with the exemptions, because if you exempted one group of people, one injured group of people out, the case would be made that you did not exempt everyone who should have been exempt, and what do you tell the people who weren't exempt that were in a category, a victim's category? Personally, that wasn't a view I shared nor a concern about the constitutionality, because as I'm sure the Senate members were aware in their discussions, the cap has been ruled constitutional in about half the states it's been imposed and unconstitutional in another half of the states it's been imposed. I'm not certain, and counsel advised us that the constitutional question, the exemptions would have no bearing on that. Nonetheless, we could not reach a compromise position with the exemptions. My concern was that people would be adequately able to be compensated if they were severely damaged. And approach the cap at a much higher level than what we ended up settling on, which was $550,000. I guess that's the best explanation of how we arrived at 550 as a compromise.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Senator Cohen.
I just want to make sure if I could ask counsel. I haven't had a chance to compare the words. Did you change any of the definitions? I see you've added future damages. Is that just broken out differently, or is that a... Tell me what that addition means, or I'm interested in some of the other technical things as well.
Right.
So I guess that's...
I would ask our counsel, Catherine, if you might want...
I wasn't involved in preparing that draft. However, I think it came about because there was a provision in the bill that had periodic payments in it which required future damages, and perhaps it should be deleted.
In fact, the subcommittee version of the bill had a periodic payment section, and I think counsel is correct, that was included. We did not, obviously, an oversight on our part, we didn't strike the future damages section once periodic was taken out. I believe the language is...
in the quick reading, Mr. Chairman, kind of looks the same to me, except for that.
There was no discussion. Representative Phillips might want to jump in here. I don't remember any discussion on language changes in the section. It was over the amount.
There should be no changes whatsoever.
Yes, Representative Springer.
I would just note, I think if you do compare the difference in definition, you'll find that when we refer to economic damages, there is a difference at the end of the third line there. In the House version, I think we've made it clear that loss of income and impairment of earning capacity applies not only to past, but specifically as well to future circumstances as well. And I don't know that that was so stated. It was probably understood, but I believe that is an additional variation.
That's correct.
Thank you.
I think it was meant for purposes of clarification, not as a substantive change. As I understand the definitions generally of what constitutes general versus special damages or economic versus non-economic. Although I don't know that there's necessarily a one-on-one relationship between what we consider general damages and special damages and economic versus non-economic laws.
That is correct, yeah. Yes, for example, lost earnings up to the time of trial would be a part of special damages under the present nomenclature, whereas under this bill, I would fall in the economic damage loss category. I'm sorry, Representative Springer, I didn't catch where you said these other words were on line.
It's the end of the third line of the definition of economic damages. The last word there you'll find make specific reference to future impairment.
Oh, yes. That's line one, the end of line one of B engrossed.
The only other thing I would add, it seems arbitrary that we arrived at that cap, and I think at the level of the cap, and I think that at a certain point the subcommittee was trying to enhance availability through what Representative Bunn referred to yesterday through predictability. And I don't think there was all that much data, if any, or all that much. There weren't that many witnesses who stepped forward and suggested that the price would be lowered for insurance as much as availability because of the predictability of the cap. And at some point, we approached the cap and set the rate. If you want to switch over to punitives, I can probably talk about that, and then Representative Phillips might want to address joint settlement.
Yes, Representative Springer, go ahead.
Excuse me, before we leave caps, I think we ought to just maybe go through all the differences on 6 and 7, and I'm sure members have noted this, but The Senate passed version indicated that the jury would be advised of the limitations. The House version changed that to indicate that the jury would not be advised of the limitation. And I believe that the House version also went on to require a more specific provision as it relates to the verdict and the form of the verdict. And those are areas that I wanted to make sure the Senate was also aware of.
The verdict form from the C. Engrossed, I didn't get on here, but it's found in Section 15 of the C. Engrossed, and I'll make sure that the next time we meet that's in there. But it is identical to what's identified as Section 5A in the D. Engrossed version.
Okay, what section of C. Engrossed does 5A come in, did you say? Did you mention what section of?
It's Section 15.
Section 15
of the C. Engrossed.
Of the C. Engrossed, we find the same language as we have in
5A
of the D. Engrossed.
That's correct.
The question of whether or not to advise the jury, there was very little agreement among the parties interested, and I guess that we finally concluded that it would be best not to advise the jury in order to reach a more fair, or let the jury have the opportunity to reach their own conclusions without being advised of the cap. It wasn't a point of great debate, nor do I think a stickling point in our negotiations. We just settled on that. I think perhaps it could have easily have gone in the other way is what I'm suggesting. I don't know if Representative Phillips would concur with that or not.
It wouldn't have been that easy, but it was not extensive.
Okay.
All right, I think that's pretty clear from the in this part of our discussion, what the differences are. All right. I would hope that all the differences would be that clear, but I'm not sure they're going to be. All right, go ahead.
I would ask members to move to the punitive section, which is at the very front. We heard testimony in committee, in subcommittee, that indicated that the Senate version not allowing to insure for punitive damages could potentially hurt economic development efforts in the state. Corporations would incorporate in other states where they could insure for punitive damages. That is why we changed, that's the primary reason why we changed this particular section. The second Section 4A in the D. Engrossed bill, I also believe, was a result of testimony from a witness, a law professor from the University of Oregon, who suggested that we outline some criteria for when the employer is responsible and when he isn't, if an employee acts in a manner in which a liability situation could arise. And that explains the second change as well. I believe those were the only two changes we allowed.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Coleman.
Can I ask a question about, it's my understanding that that is codifying, is that or is that not close to, is that codifying standard practice of some cases or whatever, or is that somebody, something that a professor dreamed up?
I believe it was a counsel, if you could.
I think it'd be a very significant change in, as I understand the law today.
Really?
Okay. Well,
because I've heard two different kinds of things. One was a codification, and I need to understand what it really is.
I think, I believe that there was some case law presented at the time by that professor regarding this particular section, and I just threw the case out yesterday and clearing my desk off. But do you remember that?
He
actually
gave
us a handout.
I'll certainly check on it, but
okay.
I do not remember.
I think, Senator Cohen, that perhaps that's what people are making reference to, that it codifies existing case law, I think.
Well, I would definitely like that checked out. My feeling is that it does not codify current case law, which would impose punitive damages on the owner of the tavern where the barkeep beats up somebody. Certainly it's not an act. Well, normally it wouldn't be an authorized act, and assuming that the barkeep is not in a managerial capacity, but there are a number of Oregon cases on that point. One involves a car dealership in Portland, so it should be easy to find the answer. Not that that should necessarily determine what we do here, but I do think this goes beyond current case law, and maybe that's what we want to do. Representative Springer.
I think the research that you requested is appropriate, because I think we ought to have that question answered for sure, as long as there's any doubt. And perhaps we could also ask counsel to contact, if it was Professor Vetri who served on the task force, who may be able to assist as we try to find the correct answer there.
All right, that'd be fine. I think we ought to clear that up. And then just be a simple policy matter, I suppose. Go ahead,
Mr. Chairman, unless I was daydreaming, there is one other difference in here in the punitive damage section.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to.
One last thing is that it sets up a separate trial, if you will. I'm not sure if that's the proper legal language, but another trial to award punitives is also contained within this measure, and I don't think the Senate had that provision.
That's for sure, and it's not an insignificant change.
Right.
It's a fairly substantial change in my view. I think it might be well, and I invite little throw-outs along the way if you feel that you want to express your philosophy or get something in the record, but it was the charge of the task force. And then it was, I think, the Senate Judiciary Committee's intention, although we departed from it, but the task force, which is the genesis of this whole bill here, was charged with, at least we decided at the very outset, that what we wanted to do was to find ways of reducing the cost of liability insurance and making it more available. And I'll have to admit that from time to time over the course of 10 months, some member of the task force would raise the question as to whether we still really had that goal in mind or whether we were off doing something else. I would say at this point only this, that it's obvious that the cost of litigation, certainly the trial of a case, is going to be increased substantially if you bifurcate it and retry the issue of punitive damages in a supplemental proceeding. And I'm quite concerned about that potential cost to litigants. So that covers
that's the punitives.
Yeah, and I would say to the House members, I think the task force rationale and the Senate rationale was simply that we didn't want to abolish punitive damages, and I guess saying that insuring for punitive damages was contrary to public policy was kind of a compromise, I suppose. And I know that not only business interests, but I think local government is concerned about the ability to insure against punitive damages, because they will lie in, even though they're not permissible under the State Tort Claims Act, why they're still recoverable in federal court cases, as I understand it. So, okay. Anything else in this section?
There is one other difference.
The
de-engrossed version includes a standard for evaluating punitive damages. Intentional and malicious, reflect a wanton and reckless disregard of the health, and so on, was in the task force bill originally and was deleted from the Senate bill and is now back in.
All right, and I'm glad you brought that up, counsel. You want to address that? It's just there, okay. I guess the reason that we took it out in the Senate side is simply because it stated just in case law. I think that was our rationale. I'll have to check that out, though. You remember, Counselor, on that?
Mr. Chairman, I think that was one of our neatness nights.
That might have been, yeah.
I recall some comment to the effect that it's now a common law standard, and at least one person expressed the desire to leave that standard flexible with the courts rather than locking it into statute. But I don't know if the whole committee felt that way.
Okay, so we've got all right. My guess is we kind of probably be able to get together on that in some way without prolonged argument. That's just my feeling from what's been said here. All right,
Representative Phillips. Could you carry on the dialogue on the joint and several section? The second one in.
Well, the most significant difference, members, is the change from 10% to 20%, and the provision on the D.N. Gross for an exemption for liability on the legal or illegal dumping of a hazardous substance is defined in current statute.
Okay, Representative Phillips, could you, I think we're very interested in this part. I think we've got some questions in our mind about the change and the percentage. Can you kind of give us the benefit of your thinking on that?
Well, there was considerable discussion with regard to this, and we felt that there were many members of the House, at least that talked to me, that felt that 10% was far too low of a standard, a threshold. Some, in fact, that felt 20% was not adequate enough, and this was where we arrived at. And I understand in the Senate discussions there was some discussion, if not proposals, with regard to a higher threshold.
Now, those two sections are precisely the same with the exception of the 10 versus 20. Is that it?
I believe so. And
yes.
You'll notice on Section 15 was the section that originally came up earlier I think it's now Section 5. So that is in here, but it's in a different spot.
Right.
So with the exception of the sub 5 on D engrossed and the change from 10 to 20, they should be identical.
All right. Senator Cohn, I know, was very involved in this part of the discussions, the Senate side. As you can imagine, there was a serious debate as to whether we should recommend any changes at all in the rule of joint and several liability, and that's one of the real big issues that all of us have grappled with. And I wonder, Senator Cohn, since you were quite involved with trying to work out what I guess some would consider a compromise, did you want to express any thoughts about how the Senate arrived at that particular percentage?
At 10?
Yeah.
Well, I suppose the compromise was between 0 and 20, and we dealt with it at 10.
I think that's
the same. I think it's legitimately the same argument that the House went through, and there are people who believe that you know, abolish it altogether. There are people who say you ought to leave it totally in full force for the non-economic damages, and that's really, I think.
Christian?
Yes.
I would say in carrying a minority report in the Senate that amongst the 13 members of my caucus, 20% in the minority report was a compromise within my caucus. Looking at the majority report at 10, the fact there are a good number in my caucus that wanted a complete elimination of joint and several, 20% was about the lowest number they really wanted to go.
Yeah, I guess everybody's heard all the arguments of why we have the doctrine to start with and why we've had it for all this period of time. There's no sense in going through that. But I'll put out this thought that maybe, I don't know what's taken up in the House or not, but you know, you folks kind of ignored, I guess, didn't ignore, but I don't know whatever happened in Senate Bill 222, but that had to do with the third-party practice being eliminated in tort cases. And I just mentioned to you that I thought the value of that is even more important when you get into changing the doctrine of joint and several liability, because if you expect, and the higher you go with the percentage, the more you're going to have these initial defendants looking around for somebody else to spread the blame on, because if they can get enough folks in there and the juries can come in with 20% or less than 20% at fault, why, of course, then they're just going to have several liabilities. So my guess is that as long as we got third-party practice, the higher you raise the percentage here, the more searching around for third-party defendants is going to go on, and that is going to complicate the case and cause more expenses. So that's, I suppose, one of the reasons that we were interested in 222's provision on third-party practice. Any other comments on this section here?
I think there was complete agreement. Maybe I'm overstating on Section 5, but I don't think anyone was interested in our committee in letting those who dump illegally or legally those wastes off the hook, because there may be 10 or 12 of them dumping at the site, and all of them only 8% responsible. They shouldn't be let off because
Mr. Chairman, I think for the record you want to state that, that's really the standard of this federal superfund, and we've had a lot of debate in the Natural Resources Committee about whether we ought to deviate at all from the federal law in that arena, and as much as it seems onerous to the companies involved, they'd rather parallel the federal statute and have one set of litigation to try to comply with in the whole thing. So I don't think that you're going to find out any of us. This is probably inadvertently left out. It's really
okay. I think what I'm going to do is, if you don't mind, unless you folks want to be real formal, I'm just going to call you by your first names.
College kids, for whatever reason, as a prank, went out to steal a pig from a farm, and one of the college students was electrocuted by an electric fence protecting that particular farm animal. Would there not be a case for liability there under anyway, those were the arguments that were made. What we could agree to as a committee was the inclusion of Class C contained in ORS chapters 161, I believe, through 169. I am not sure, and due to time, I reviewed those chapters briefly, but perhaps this committee would want to review those chapters, because I'm not certain that what we attempted to exempt is we were able to do that by putting those chapters into the law.
Mr. Chairman, you indeed may want to, if you want to revisit this issue, bring in Representative Bunn, who was the author of this specific section, and I would think that might be appropriate.
As I read it now, tell me if I'm wrong, but the only difference is that you've included the Class C felonies that are contained in those specified
right.
chapters. Everything else is the same.
That's correct.
Well, not really, no, because in the Senate version, if you'll notice up at the top of the page, it's a defense in an action based on ordinary negligence. Under the Senate version, if the claim is based on gross negligence or intentional action, somebody's robbing your house, you've got a gun on them, and they say, okay, I'll quit, and you shoot them anyway. I mean, that's not covered under the Senate version. Under the House version, I think that says it's a complete defense. Now, whether that's included in the 161 to 169, I don't remember exactly. But the difference is that the House version, it's a defense to any action, whether it's based on ordinary negligence, gross negligence, or intentional conduct. So it's much broader.
Well, indeed it is much broader. And of course, that's the concern. And you could cite examples that are much more serious, maybe realistic than what Dave just gave us. We got oftentimes, people getting shot as they run away from the scenes of burglaries or other offenses that would be Class C felonies. And I don't know whether the fact that you're involved in some low-grade Class C felony involving property could give the police or the landowner complete authority to kill you. That kind of concerns me a bit. Do you have a comment, Dick?
I don't know if we have much discussion on the House side about attempt and how that would affect the C felony category. Generally, if you have an attempt and you're convicted of an attempt, it's the next lower category. And presumably an attempted C felony would be an A misdemeanor. I don't know if that's an issue at all. And if we were to go with the Senate version, that may not be anything we need to consider.
Well, I assume the House members did consider the situation I've described, because if you haven't, I'd like to have you think about it. I mean, it's kind of a license to kill or maim, really, to the landowner or the law enforcement people. In a way, if you don't limit it to cases of ordinary negligence, so.
Well, Senator.
Go ahead.
We did discuss it at some length, both in committee and out of committee. Uh-huh. This was a rather hotly debated issue at times.
All right, and I guess so. The way you put it to start with, maybe, is the only way you can put it, and that is some folks think that if you're involved in the commission of crime, why you really shouldn't have any claim for the injuries.
Okay. That would be accurate.
Call of the House. Wonderful. Well, I'll tell you what, it's about 17 minutes to 3. We have people going to 3 o'clock meetings. Let me. Is 1 o'clock a good time? We'll be in session in the mornings, and apparently you people are in session. How about, is 1 o'clock a good time for everybody here?
Sure.
All right, let's meet tomorrow at 1 o'clock again, should we? We have a session tonight, or I'd maybe suggest something tonight. 1 o'clock tomorrow, then, and we'll be adjourned until then. Thank you.